It's been a while since we've talked housing, so we're going to do some of that on the program today. Also, an update from Philadelphia, Tennessee, from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 26th of July. Great as always to have you along, everybody. The American housing market is where we choose to begin today. The oft-cited and much-respected S&P Case-Shiller Home Price Index came out this morning. The 20-city average was up 5.2% year-over-year, which is fine. In the already expensive San Francisco Bay Area, however, prices were up 6.5%, which explains what I'm about to say. Facebook, right there smack in the heart of Silicon Valley, is planning a big expansion of its headquarters, employee headcount, office space, the whole deal. And this is the interesting part, it's promising to build new housing, too, housing that will be available to people even if they don't work at Facebook. From our desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has more.
It's a good bet the Bay Area will continue to grow economically while its residents grow increasingly desperate for housing. David Blitzer heads the index committee at S&P.
Job growth will bring more people into the region, will increase the demand for housing, and people keep bidding up the prices of houses based on what their income is.
Matthew Franklin is president of MidPen Housing, a nonprofit that builds affordable housing in Silicon Valley.
In the last 5 years, we've created 120,000 new jobs and 20,000 new housing units. So it's just an unsustainable imbalance. We've got folks paying 70-80% of their income towards housing expense.
Enter Facebook, based in Menlo Park. It plans to add 6,500 jobs. MidPen anticipates receiving some funding from Facebook for affordable housing, and Franklin says the company plans to put up 1,500 new units, 15% of them for low- or middle-income residents, whether they work at Facebook or not.
I think it's a very robust affordable housing benefits program. It's not going to solve all the housing problems, and I think everyone's clear on that.
Small business person Kristen Evans says not by a long shot. She helps manage Kepler's Books, a couple of miles from Facebook. She's lost employees because of soaring rents. She set up a website to collect their stories.
Facebook is not the only contributor to the problem, but they are the current major project that's being proposed. If there's going to be commercial job growth, there needs to be housing as well.
And Evans sees Facebook's pledge of a couple hundred affordable rent apartments as a drop in the bucket. Facebook didn't respond by our deadline to comment on this story. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Today in foods that can make you sick, that bag of flour in the cupboard. General Mills is expanding a recall of flour products that began in May because of E. coli. Marketplace's Annie Baxter looks at why flour can make you sick.
General Mills says this is the first E. coli outbreak confirmed in connection with flour. Its recall includes batches of its best-selling gold medal flour. The company is urging consumers not to eat uncooked batter or dough, whether it be cookie dough, cake batter, or even homemade Play-Doh. Felicia Wu teaches food science and nutrition at Michigan State University, and she says even back in her seventh grade home ec class, she learned uncooked flour could make you sick.
Even then, in the late 1980s, we were taught that we should not eat this flour raw. It had to be baked.
Wu says the fact is both harmless and harmful bacteria are really common in the environment, including the wheat fields flour comes from.
The pathogens might be in the water that's used to irrigate the crops.
Or they could come from, say, the droppings of wildlife traipsing through the fields. Sandra Eskin directs the Safe Food Project at the Pew Charitable Trusts. She says E. coli could then spread onto the equipment used to harvest, transport, store, or process wheat into flour.
It can cross-contaminate many, many other parts of the facility and then therefore contaminate a lot of the flour, even when it may have started with a relatively small amount.
Federal agencies and General Mills are investigating the cause of the E. coli outbreak linked to flour. The company says only a small subset of flour produced at its Kansas City plant has been traced to consumers who got sick, but the company has increased cleaning protocols at the facility. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Wall Street today was fine. Little of this, little of that. You know how it goes. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We'll be right back. So, Democrats, Philadelphia, Bill Clinton is the big speech at the convention tonight. We, however, in keeping with our tradition these past 2 weeks, have decided a different Philadelphia might be more illuminating. Philadelphia, Tennessee, population somewhere in the mid three figures, that is less than 1,000. Heidi Adams owns a farm there, works as a commercial real estate broker up the road in Knoxville as well. Heidi, thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Tell me about your little slice of life there in Philadelphia, Tennessee.
Our little slice of heaven. If you had told me 3 years ago that I'd be living on a farm in the middle of nowhere, I would have thought you were nuts. My entire career has been working in commercial real estate. I've always lived in big cities. When the recession hit, we left Florida, and by a series of very unusual events, we ended up on 40 acres in the middle of farming country in Philadelphia, Tennessee.
What's it like out there when you're just out with the horses and the cows and stuff?
It's heaven. It's heaven. You know, now I go and I find my peace sitting in the middle of a horse field. You know, there's nothing like it, because when I'm on my property, I'm away from the craziness of our world right now.
How's the economy out in Philadelphia, Tennessee? I mean, are the farms doing all right?
Well, this year, not so much. Because of the heat and because we're in a drought, a lot of the production is low. I spoke with my neighbor the other day, and he went to the stock barn to buy some young cattle to raise and sell. And he said that the adult steers that are ready to go to slaughter are selling way down this year. You know, the farmers are really struggling. They can't keep the livestock watered. The cornfields are green and growing, but I don't think it's going to produce the quality end result that they typically get.
When you go down to your office, you've got an office down in Knoxville, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you go down there, what's the buzz? What's the conversation?
In Knoxville, it's an entirely different conversation, because you're dealing, I'm dealing traditionally with real estate professionals and investors.
Are they feeling all right about things?
They're feeling uncertain about things.
That word keeps coming up, man. I'll tell you.
You know what's interesting, though? The uncertainty is not the same as it was 4 years ago or 8 years ago. In speaking with investors, they're still buying. They're not holding back.
When you think about this election, right, not in your Knoxville persona and not really in your Philadelphia persona either, but just you as a human being in this country, what's the thing for you? What's on your mind?
Quite honestly, I'm embarrassed. I'm embarrassed that these candidates are the best that our country has to offer.
Are you hopeful for this country?
I'm always hopeful, always hopeful. I just don't know if the two options that we have individually have the ability to pull off what needs to happen to turn this country around.
Heidi Adams, we got her in Philadelphia, Tennessee. Heidi, thanks very much.
Absolutely. I appreciate the opportunity.
I'd be remiss here if I didn't mention our pop-up podcast from the convention in the actual Philadelphia, the big one. You know, it's called Politics Inside Out, the economic news of the convention, available wherever fine podcasts can be downloaded. The 2016 Summer Olympic Games start in Brazil in just 10 days. 10,000 athletes from more than 200 national Olympic committees will be there, including Russia, which wasn't always a sure thing. Revelations of widespread performance-enhancing drug use could have brought a blanket ban. In the event, though, just 20 athletes were barred. But if history is any guide, the anti-doping lab in Rio is going to have its work cut out for it, and it has only just been allowed to start operating again. The BBC's Wira Davis reports.
Grunts, groans, and grappling. Brazilian freestyle wrestler Joyce Silva has a real chance of winning a medal at a home Olympics in Rio. But her sport has been plagued in the past by doping, with Russian athletes among the biggest culprits. Earlier this year, dozens of Russian wrestlers were exposed as drugs cheats, and Joyce doesn't want them in Rio. Doping is completely unfair, says the Rio-based athlete. When you're fighting and losing to an opponent who's on drugs, it's soul-destroying and it feels like you're being robbed. The Russian athletic squad is, of course, already banned from Rio. But the IOC has sidestepped the thorny issue of whether to suspend the entire Russian delegation, despite accusations of state-sponsored doping. The governing bodies of individual sports will now decide if Russians can compete. It all means a critical role for Brazil's new anti-doping lab, which will test 450 samples daily during the games. There's plenty of white noise as new state-of-the-art analytical equipment operates around the clock. But the lab has only just recovered its license to operate after being accused of failing to meet international scientific standards. The chief scientist here is Francisco Radler.
That laboratory will be the most technically efficient laboratory during the games with all the expertise the world has in anti-doping analysis. So this will be a message for those athletes that would maybe dare to cheat for the games or before the games, that they will be caught.
With the reputation of the Olympic movement under scrutiny like never before, there's huge pressure for Rio 2016 to get its anti-doping program right, to make sure that hundreds of thousands of visitors aren't shortchanged and that there's a level playing field for all competitors. The flip side is that with the huge pressure to catch drugs cheats, there's a real danger that honest athletes could be stigmatized. Beach volleyball player Pedro Solberg was denied a place at London 2012 because he was wrongly declared a drugs cheat. He feels for those clean Russian athletes who may find themselves unable to compete here in Rio.
People who didn't use drugs, who didn't do anything wrong, they should not be out of the Olympics because of other people's mistakes. I know exactly how is this feeling, you know, and I hope nobody has to pass through what I had to pass. Who used drugs must be out of the Olympics, and who didn't, I hope to see them here.
How many Russians will grace the medal podium in Rio is a big question. While there's huge pressure on the IOC to show it's serious about doping, so is the demand to let as many athletes as possible to come here and compete.
The BBC's Wira Davis in Rio. Coming up.
It's almost like retail gentrification, right? We're going to rebrand it. We're going to rename it. We're going to change how it looks.
We're going to raise prices. Oh, no. Wait a minute. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 19 points today, about a 10%, 18,473 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ up 12 points, 0.25%, 51.10. The S&P 500 flat, 21.69. After the bell today, Apple reported second quarter profits dropped 27% on slumping iPhone sales, but it still managed to beat expectations, which is arguably the most important thing. Apple shares up more than 4% in after-hours trading. Different story, however, over at Twitter, which reported a miss on revenue after the close. Shares down 10% in extended session trading. Bond prices rose today. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 1.56%. And you, yes you, you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today in mass transit news, this item, Brooklyn, you're kind of out of luck. The New York City Metropolitan Transit Agency announced this week it's going to shut down one of its busiest subway lines, the L train, for a year and a half to repair damage from Hurricane Sandy. Alternatives, the city says, buses or perhaps a long walk to another train. The L train carries almost 250,000 riders under the East River every day and serves a part of Brooklyn where real estate has been red hot. Marketplace's Sally Herships has more.
Let's be honest. Almost no one is looking forward to shutting down the L train. Neighborhood residents call the plan the L-pocalypse, like Kevin Lin.
I'm going to move.
Lin is 38, he works in tech, and he says he doesn't like the idea of having his daily commute doubled. Thus, his plan.
I'm not going to stay in that part of Brooklyn. Yeah, so I'm going to move.
But in the grand scheme of things, how long is 18 months really? Lauren Rifflin is with Street Easy, a New York City real estate site. She says there are different viewpoints.
There's a near-term perspective and a long-term perspective.
Rifflin says Williamsburg, one of the hottest markets on the L train, is big with renters. And if a lease you're considering overlaps with construction,
that could be something for them to think about. Buyers, on the other hand,
may have a different outlook. Sarah Burke is with the real estate firm Douglas Elliman.
You buy an apartment thinking you're going to be living there for 5 to 7 years.
So while losing transportation could be painful, it is only temporary. And Burke says the shutdown could also mean a slowdown on the kind of bidding wars that Williamsburg typically sees for apartments. And with low interest rates, you could get a deal. But Thomas Dodd isn't so sure.
I'm not making any big bets. Let's put it that way.
Dodd owns Brooklyn Fireproof, film and TV studios. He shoots shows like Top Chef and Beat Bobby Flay, and he's got a really basic concern.
Getting customers.
So Dodd says he's expanding way beyond the L train, outside the city, anywhere he can find affordable real estate and local support. In New York, on the F train, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Wall Street, which we talk about a lot on this program, is an actual place, of course, but it's also a label used to refer to big banks and stock exchanges and, generally speaking, all things finance, right? In reality, though, what we're talking about when we say Wall Street today includes investment firms in Midtown Manhattan, hedge funds in Connecticut, banks headquartered across the river in Jersey or out in the suburbs. And as Marketplace's Lewis Wallace reports, Wall Street is also headed south.
This is Wall Street.
It's just before 9 a.m. and people are filing out of the train to work on Wall Street. It's pretty. Brick streets, old marble and stone buildings. But overall, it's kind of hushed. Jamal Albuquer has been selling coffee from a cart here for a long time. He says each year it's been generally a little quieter for him, or more than a little.
Much, much quieter.
In a place where growth is pretty much the name of the game, growth has slowed. Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and Citigroup have all announced layoffs in the past year. And of course, cost-cutting is the other name of the game.
The costs of living in a place like New York continue to go up.
Catherine Wild heads the Partnership for New York City, an association of New York CEOs that put out a report last year saying New York's future as the world financial capital is at risk. The group surveyed Wall Street businesses it works with and found most of them have either moved jobs out of New York recently or say they'd consider it, citing cost as their major concern. And technology makes it easy to shift around lots of positions.
Technology jobs, business services, administrative jobs.
So, quote-unquote, Wall Street offices have been opening from Jersey to Texas. According to Bureau of Labor Statistics data, finance jobs in New York City proper are down 10% from a 20-year high in 2000. The South and Southwest have become hotspots. Tampa Metro has seen a 7% increase over that same time. Dallas-Fort Worth, a 38% increase.
The states that are winning financial services jobs are basically sending a message, we appreciate you, we want you, we'll support you.
And outside of New York, firms can pay people less for the same work. Taxes are often lower and rents are cheaper. Plus, if a corporation wants to just build its own offices or campus, it can. Suburban sprawl is still a thing. The first big wave of relocations was after 9/11 when firms decided to create fully redundant centers where they could run their operations in case of emergency. The next wave was moving back office jobs, and now even more is up for grabs: advisors, traders, fund managers. DTCC, which processes financial transactions for major banks, opened up a Tampa office in the 2000s. Marie Chinisi Everett is the chief marketing officer.
We can run our company seamlessly from Tampa. In fact, we needed to do that after Superstorm Sandy.
She says now the company has 20% of its workforce there, more than in New York. She moved to Tampa from New York a few years ago, and she's into it.
You know, the sun is shining. You know, you have beautiful waterfront views.
It's on Eastern time, and there's an airport. Oh, and the commute's not bad.
I used to sit in traffic for an hour and 45 minutes in New York, and I'm door-to-door in 30 minutes here.
I met another guy who's watched Wall Street, the actual street, through some ups and downs. Dusty Rhodes, he's a saxophone player who takes advantage of the eerie echoes created by the columns outside the Deutsche Bank building.
Well, I haven't necessarily seen a shift yet. Like, all of a sudden, Wall Street's not Wall Street. You know what I mean?
To him, it mostly still feels like business as usual. In New York, I'm Lewis Wallace for Marketplace.
People who've spent any decent amount of time in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania the past 20 or 30 years probably know about a place called The Gallery. It's a 1 million square foot mall pretty much in the heart of Center City. And when it opened, and for years afterward, it was a hub for teenagers and retirees and working class shoppers as well. But The Gallery is getting a facelift, and along with it, a whole bunch of new, more upscale stores, stores that are perhaps out of reach of the old clientele. From WHYY in Philadelphia, Todd Bookman reports.
When The Gallery opened in 1977, the hope was to lure suburban shoppers back into what was at the time a gritty downtown Philadelphia. But the mall on Market Street became a place that urban shoppers came to love, too. An underground maze of kiosks and shops. John Rouse owned one of them.
Complexion Plus in the mall over there, right next to Radio Shack.
What kind of store was it?
Health and Beauty Aids.
Rouse says there was always a steady stream of customers, in part because both a commuter train and subway have stops connected to the complex. Today, those trains still run, but most of the stores are shuttered.
It's different now, but back then it was real good back in those days.
Last year, the mall's owners unveiled plans to renovate The Gallery, bring in new stores, redo the tired interior, and in theory, lure more customers. While the construction continues, commuters can still pass through what's left of the old food court.
If you were here, you would see a Popeye's chicken here. You would see that Smoothie King was still there.
As a kid, Solomon Jones spent a lot of time here.
And you would see all kinds of people. You would see old people. You would see young people. You'd see women with baby carriages, some business people walking by. And so it was a pretty vibrant area here. It was a place where people came to have lunch.
Jones is now a writer and columnist. He says The Gallery was especially important to the city's black residents. Many of them came here from poorer neighborhoods with limited shopping options. He's worried the new space, to be called the Fashion Outlets of Philadelphia, won't fill that need.
It's almost like retail gentrification, right? We're going to rebrand it. We're going to rename it. We're going to change how it looks. And we're going to make sure that we're reaching out to people who don't look like the people who are already here.
There's development taking place throughout Philadelphia right now. Like many American cities, it's attracting younger, wealthier residents who want commerce that matches their tastes. Ann Fedulin is the city's director of planning and development.
You know, the old saying goes, the only thing that's inevitable is change. And Philadelphia right now is experiencing a lot of change all at the same time. We're seeing a lot of our communities change. We're seeing our downtown certainly go through some change.
Fedulin says the renovated gallery won't be totally unrecognizable, but it's nearly 40 years old and due for an update. Plus, she says it may help draw more customers to the street-level shops surrounding the mall. John Rouse has no interest in reopening his Complexion Plus beauty store in the remodeled space, but he is behind the project.
I'd just like to see it get back to the old ways and really, really turn things around. I think it'll be all right then.
For now, though, much of The Gallery feels like a ghost town. Walls have been erected around areas that are under construction. And while you can hear what's going on behind them, it's a place to pass through, not to shop. In Philadelphia, I'm Todd Bookman for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a word here about the labor market and this election. This weekend on CNN's Sunday show State of the Union, an interview between Jake Tapper, the host of the program, and Donald Trump Jr. turned to the unemployment rate, about which Trump said this.
These are artificial numbers, Jake. These are numbers that are massaged to make the existing economy look good, to make this administration look good, when in fact, it's a total disaster.
To use as straightforward and clear a word as possible here, that is a lie. Reasonable people can and do disagree about the health of this economy and how to measure the labor market, but the idea that the Bureau of Labor Statistics manipulates the monthly unemployment report is without any basis in fact. Same thing goes, by the way, for the Republican nominee's claim that unemployment in this country is at 42%. This is not, to quote, as it happens, Jake Tapper, an anti-Trump position or a pro-Clinton position. It is a pro-truth position. All right, we're done. We got to go. The Down Duster was kind of meh today. 19 points on the downside at 10%, 18,473. The NASDAQ up, though, 12 points, about a quarter percent, 5110. The S&P 500 pretty much flat, 2169. Tommy Andres and Vanessa Smith are the producers on our elections desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Nishat Kerwa, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow back here, everybody. This is APN.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.